Hello and welcome to episode 26. I am TJ and this is TJ's Garden. In this episode, we're going to be talking about hot weather gardening, also hot climate gardening, however you want to say that. First, I want to talk a little bit about what I'm growing in my garden right now, though. Last time I was saying that I was kind of getting a late start and it was taking me a while to get everything up and going, but things are kind of going now. I don't have a lot that is producing heavily just yet, except I'm growing a variety of Greek cucumber. It's actually the same cucumber, I believe, is an Armenian cucumber. This is just a Greek variety of that. So it's a shorter, kind of rounder variety. It doesn't have the long, in some cases, quite long fruit of the traditional Armenian cucumber, but it has the same kind of flavor and texture and everything. So it's a melon that has the flavor, texture, everything very similar to a cucumber. And I've been eating quite a lot of them. It produces quite a lot of them. In fact, I might actually have some while I'm editing this episode later. Cause I have some in the fridge. Everything else is kind of going a little slow because I have a lot of like squash, watermelon. I have the loofah growing. All these are ones that are going to take a little while to start actually producing. The roselles aren't quite big enough to flower just yet. So mostly what I'm getting out of the garden right now are some beans here and there. I'm waiting for the next big group of beans that I planted a little more intensively to start coming up. And the cucumbers and... I get Malabar spinach whenever I want it. It's just not as easy to use fresh, so I have to wait until I have, you know, enough that I want to cook. And then I have amaranth coming out all the time, and I will actually be explaining why I get so much amaranth in this episode. And of course, you know, the flower garden is still producing flowers. I'm getting a few tomatoes here and there, but our weather is really kind of hot for them to produce properly. So there's a lot of tomatoes just sitting there on hold, and it's just... It's very irritating every day to look at them and see all these tomatoes just hanging in bunches, all, you know, lovely trusses of tomatoes down the plant, and they're all green and they're all staying green and they're gonna stay green until the weather gets back down in the 90s reliably. I'm getting a few ripening here and there, but mostly they're gonna hold on until the weather comes back, which is another thing I'll be talking about. So rather than telling you all the things I'll be talking about, let's actually get into the subject. So the thing about plants that's going to tell you a lot about their weather tolerances, their amount of heat they can take, how they're going to do over the summer, is the type of photosynthesis they do. There are three main types. You can get in the weeds kind of studying the different sort of subtypes within there, but there are three main chemical pathways. C3, C4, and CAM. C3 is the main traditional sort of default way plants photosynthesize. And it's called C3 because the first molecule it produces is a carbon chain with three carbons. So this is the normal pathway, works really great. But once you start getting above about 70-ish degrees, it starts breaking down and doesn't work. And so most plants, the vast majority of plants, are C3 plants, and they just sort of put things on hold in hot weather. Some of them die back a little bit. Some of them just look terrible when it gets, you know, in the really high degrees if you're in the tropics or in other places. Some kind of jump over the heat. A lot of our spring ephemerals here in California, you also have a lot of, you know, spring, early summer flowers. And basically all they do is they do all their photosynthesis in the spring when it's warm enough for them to actually function, but not so hot they can't photosynthesize. They do all that, store all that energy. And then once the weather starts to peak up, they shoot to flower, produce seed, and are done, right? Because once they start flowering, they don't really have to produce anything anymore. They're using the stored energy from earlier. So they do that, they bolt, they produce their seed, and then they die. And then the seeds skip over to next year, and they start all over again in the spring. So they never actually are live during the high heat to speak of, which is one strategy. Other plants just weather the storm and come out of it in the fall and start functioning again. And we see a lot of that in our crop plants. But the other form of common photosynthesis is C4. Now, 90-something percent of plants are actually C3, and only C3. C4 is a modification. It's a pathway that's developed from C3. And so most plants that produce the necessary compound, it's called PEP. I believe it's PEPC. For not as in the drink, but PEP. C, the letter C. It's actually produced as a sort of next step in the chain for C3, which means it's still producing the compounds necessary for C3, and they do function under C3 to some degree up until they reach the higher temperatures. And once they do reach those high temperatures, then they switch to C4 photosynthesis and can function through the summer. And the amaranth I talked about earlier is a C4 plant. There are several grains that are C4 plants. As you can kind of see already, C4 plants aren't closely related to each other. This has occurred several times in several different lineages, mostly monocots, some sedges, and allodid dicots. But the majority are monocots, so a lot of our grains and everything else have C4 variants. And because this is an adaptation of C3, they still can do C3, so they function in both climates to a degree. Some of these do not do very well in cold climates. They can't photosynthesize well because they don't produce enough. But they can do some, and then they function great in the higher heat. And so my amaranth is going to produce all summer long. It's going to produce beautifully because it's photosynthesizing right up until it gets into those higher hundreds, and then it starts cutting out for a little bit. But it's photosynthesizing most of the day, whereas all the C4 plants in my garden are photosynthesizing in the 80s, starting to kind of slow down there, really breaking down when it hits 90s, and finally just stopping during the 100-degree temperature in the middle of the day and then picking back up in the evening. And I might get into a little bit. They have other adaptations. But when it comes to photosynthesis, these are the two main pathways. There's a third pathway that's seen in a lot of arid climate plants. So your cactuses, euphorbias, a few other plants. And that is crassular acid metabolism. So-called because it was originally discovered in Crassula plants. But it is called CAM more often. Everybody I've ever heard just says CAM. And CAM photosynthesis is a little bit weirder. To preserve water during the day and to prevent some of the water loss that actually causes severe wilting, which can lead to the fatal wilt point, they actually hold up their stomata, the little air exchange valves, closed during the day. So they don't actually do gas exchange during the day. They store gases in chemically that they exchange at night. So they get all the CO2 they need. They store that chemically. And then during the day, they photosynthesize with it. And then at night, they open up, release water vapor, pull in CO2 again, and then do the whole thing over again the next day. So they're releasing far less water vapor than they would be during the hot day. This is a very effective form of photosynthesis for those climates. The downside of it is it's not very productive. And so very few rapid growing plants actually make use of it, which means very few crop plants make use of it. The only ones that really do are, pineapples are a CAM plant and cactus. Those are the two main ones I can think of. And keep in mind, cactus includes both the, opuntias that give us our prickly pears and the dragon fruit plant, both of which are cacti. You have these three different forms of photosynthesis, but they aren't the only ways that plants deal with hot weather. One way is, and I've seen this a lot in my golden nugget squash this year, one way is that they will actually wilt. And we generally think of wilt as something that kills our plants, but it isn't always the case. And I see this a lot when I look in like gardening groups online, especially ones centered around where I live, Bakersfield, California, but other hot climate areas. People panic, new gardeners especially, panic when they see their plants wilting. But it's not always a bad thing. Some plants, like the squash I'm talking about, will wilt down to sort of lower the amount of surface area they're exposing to the sun. It's also just a byproduct of the fact that they're putting out too much moisture through their leaves, and so they aren't able to maintain what's called turgidity in the cells. Plants do not stand up, at least herbaceous plants, green plants, soft plants. They don't stand up by any kind of internal structure. They don't have a skeleton. They don't have anything strong. Woody plants use a substance called lignin. That's what wood really is it's this lignin. And lignified plants or woody plants stay up because lignin, it forms sort of a skeletal structure and gives them that strength to stand up. But an herbaceous plant, like a squash plant, doesn't have that. All the cells maintain their firmness and their size by filling themselves up with water. And so when the plant is losing water out of its stomata, when it's basically doing photosynthesis and it's releasing water vapor, when it loses more than it can take up from its roots, the plant will start to wilt because it's literally deflating. And so squash plants and other plants take advantage of this, and they use it to lower their surface area. They also, because leaves are kind of hanging down, they're covering other parts of the plant, and pretty much any green part of the plant is photosynthesizing to some degree. So if it results in cooling the center of the plant sufficiently, the plant can continue some photosynthesis. It's not going to be great, but it will sustain it through that hot part of the day. And so on a daily basis, I watch these plants wilt down and then pop right back up, and wilt down and pop right back up. And they'll do this until our weather gets back down into the mid to low 90s. And then they'll pretty much just stay up all the time. Other cucurbits don't necessarily do this. I don't see the Greek cucumbers I'm growing doing this. They seem to be just fine in the heat. And I don't see the luffah doing this. So those are both tropical plants. That kind of makes a lot of sense. But yeah, that's one way they kind of deal with it. Another way is some of them have kind of hair. You'll see some cacti that are covered in hair. If you look at a pineapple leaf, it looks kind of gray. And that's because it has these little trichome hairs that you can't really see. They're very common in pretty much all the bromeliads. And you can't really see them very well, but they're kind of fuzzy and they protect the leaves a little bit from high heat. They're these little crystalline, almost needle-like structures when you look at them under a microscope. And they help protect the leaf. So you see a lot of these kinds of structures. Some plants really reduce all their structures. So you'll see woody plants out in the desert that have very small leaves, and they will drop their leaves during dry periods. Octeo is a common plant you see out there a lot of the year. An octeo just looks like a bunch of sticks. And then when it gets a little water, it'll put out leaves and kick back onto photosynthesis and everything else. And then when the water disappears, it drops the leaves and it goes kind of dormant again until the next rain cycle. Also, the Palo Verde trees that we have all over the Southwest, they have very reduced leaves for the same reason. They're trying to limit their exposure to the sun by limiting the size of their structures. So there are a lot of those kinds of ways plants deal with heat. You don't see a lot of very specialized heat reduction strategies in crop plants. They do exist, but you don't tend to see them as much. So the ones I've talked about are kind of the main ones you're going to see. The only other main strategy is, as I've already said, C4. Corn is a C4 plant. Most of our grains can be C4. The winter grains aren't, but the summer grains are. Sorghum is a C4 plant that grows just fine through even the hottest summers. And then anything in the amaranth family is also a C4 plant, so those do just fine. So you've got options during a hot summer for plants that will thrive. And there are plenty of plants that will weather the storm and get through a summer. So your garden doesn't have to be empty just because you're hitting 102 or 103. Now, there are some things you do need to wait for. And these are things, again, I see all the time in forums where people are complaining. It's my plant isn't, especially tomatoes, by the way. My tomato plant isn't keeping its flowers. They're all falling off. None of them are turning into fruit. My tomato fruit is just staying on the vine. It isn't ripening. How do I get it to ripen? And most of these are to do with heat. Tomato plants only ripen their fruit within certain temperature differences. If you read Craig Hillier's Epic Tomatoes, and I'll post a link. I did an interview with him. It was a lot of fun. If you read his book, though, he talks about the fact that they've done research and found that tomatoes do not ripen in the sun. So that whole business people tell you of, you know, remove some leaves and let the sun ripen the fruit. The sun doesn't ripen the fruit. What ripens it is heat. When it's within the right temperatures, a tomato will ripen. It's just the way the plant handles it. Now, admittedly, the plant is trying to do this because it's trying to time this with the right sun exposure and the right time of year and everything. But yeah, it's pretty much just holding on to the fruit until the weather's right for it to finish ripening the plant. Weird side note, when the fruit is green, it actually does do some limited photosynthesis. It doesn't take in CO2 because it doesn't have stomata on the fruit surface, but it can use CO2 floating around from the leaves around it and that to do some limited photosynthesis. I was reading a paper about this. Cucurbits do the same thing. So those green cucumbers are also photosynthesizing, weirdly enough. And so that's part of why it hangs on to them for so long, is they're still doing their job. They're kind of maintaining things as best they can until the weather cools down and it can ripen those fruit. You have the same problem when the temperatures are too low. So if you have a cold snap and your fruit isn't ripening, that's another indicator, is that it's too cold and it's holding onto the fruit until it warms up enough for it to go through its normal ripening process. And the same is true for pollen for a lot of plants. corn, tomatoes, several other plants have been studied for this. And once you start getting well above about 97 degrees, pollen stops working. It stops being able to trigger the reactions it needs to trigger to pollinate a plant. And so when you reach those temperatures, you're going to see fruit being held and you're going to see flowers just opening for a few days and then falling off if it's a jointed variety. If it's a jointless variety, it just hangs on to dead flowers. And so you have all that, and all you have to do, you can try shading them or moving them if they're in pots. But if you don't have those as options, you just have to wait them out. Tomatoes will weather the storm and they will come out the other end. They'll look a little raggedy during the hottest heat. My tomatoes do not look great right now. A couple of them look pretty nice, but then a bunch of them are, I mean, a lot of the dwarfs right now, a lot of them look like ugly little sticks. And that's because they're weathering the storm. Once the heat goes away, once it gets back down into the 90s and 80s, they'll start slowly doing a little more photosynthesis. They'll start ripening that fruit because the tomato has ways of doing photosynthesis a little hotter than it should be able to. That's why they can thrive in summers and they will get by. They'll start giving me fruit again. I'll start seeing some nice big ones. I'm hoping to get some big beefsteak types off of one variety. The others are mostly cherry types. So I won't get anything big off of those, but I'm hoping for a couple. Same thing with my pepper plants and other things that I've started as seed. A lot of them haven't shown a lot of growth and they're again waiting. So it's just a, like with most things in gardening, it's just a patience game. Once you start hitting those 100 degree temperatures, and here in Bakersfield, that can last for months. It may be a little while before I get anything, but in other climates, you might not be so blessed. But once you get down past the 100 degrees, everything will start growing again. So don't panic. Don't worry. Don't, you know, pull anything up or start doing extreme measures to save your plants. Just wait it out and they will be fine. Okay, so now that I've told you all the ways not to worry, let's talk about times when you should be worried. Anytime you start seeing sun scald, that's the time when you need to start taking care of your plants. Check the watering, making sure that they are not over or underwatered. And to clarify, sun scald is not anything weird. It's just, it literally looks like a sunburn on your plants. The leaves will turn brown in spots. The fruit will develop blemishes that are pretty obviously sun damage. And so when you start seeing these, the first thing to check is your watering. Is the plant staying moist? Is it staying too moist? Is it getting waterlogged? Any of those things. Because unfortunately, too much water and too little water often look the same, because if you have too much water, the soil becomes waterlogged, the root hairs die, and the plant isn't taking up water, so it reacts as if it has no water. The only difference there is that you tend to see more rot than you would in dry conditions. But yeah, so if you check your watering, make sure that's okay, and then you just look at the plant. If it's sun scald, it'll start looking really ugly, you know, during the high heat. But once the heat goes away, again, it's a waiting game. The sun scald will too. You'll start see, it's not that it will leave. The leaves that are already damaged and the fruit that's already damaged, you'll want to trim off. Those will never come back. But it'll start putting out new foliage again, and that won't get sun scald. But if you start seeing a lot of it and you have the means to do so, if you provide some shade during part of the day, especially during the hottest part of the day, that can mitigate it as well. So if you have a tomato that is getting a lot of sun scald, but it's in a container, you can move that to somewhere where it only gets sun during the cooler parts of the day or for only part of the hotter part of the day, and that'll help mitigate it as well. The other thing to look out for is the permanent wilt point, and that's going to be, when you're a new gardener, it's going to be harder to identify, but you'll kind of notice when a plant wilts and then comes back, wilts and then comes back, on a daily cycle from the heat. So when you go out in the hot part of the day and your plants are all kind of hanging down, and then you come out later in the day and they perked back up, that's normal wilt. When they kind of flop over, when they start showing clear damage from wilt, when they start turning black in parts, it usually tends to start towards the tip and then work its way back. But once you start seeing those signs, that plant is a goner, because once you pass that permanent wilt point, there is physical damage to the plant and it cannot recover. Now, this is true of primarily annuals. Some perennials can come back from a permanent wilt point, but the tissue that is damaged is permanently damaged. So you have to prune it back. So those perennials that you prune back every year all the way to the ground, those can survive it because the permanent wilt point has occurred to the leaves. It may not have happened to the roots yet. But yeah, in an annual, it's pretty much just throw the plant away at that point. The way to prevent permanent wilt point is to make sure you have enough water up to the plant. And again, if possible, if it's a plant that doesn't do particularly well in high heat, shielding it will help protect it as well. So if you can get it somewhere where it's shaded or partially shaded for part of the day, that'll help it tick along as well. But yeah, once you start seeing permanent wilt point plants, you need to get them out of there, get them moved, because once one of them does it, if it's the same variety, the other ones are probably going to do it as well. Their tolerances are probably going to be pretty similar. The best bet is if you see a plant that reaches that point and you have others of the same variety right next to it, keep the water up to those. Check again to make sure it's not over or under watering, but just make sure they have sufficient water because that will help as well. Because what's happening is, just like I said before with wilt, where the roots aren't able to provide enough water, if you get too far into that, the cells aren't able to get enough water to do what they need to do to function or to protect themselves from the heat. And so they start taking damage and it becomes structural. And that's where you get that permanent wilt point where it just won't come back. Now, here's just a quick list of some plants to try out if you live in a hotter climate and you want to still grow, you know, a good crop of something during the hottest parts of the year. As far as greens go, amaranth, like I said, it's a C4 plant, so it does pretty well. You're going to want to stay away from actual spinach because that is a very cool weather crop and it does not do well in the summers when you reach, you know, 90, 100 degree temperatures. But Malabar spinach, which is completely unrelated, is a warm weather crop. It comes from India. It comes from very hot parts of India. And it's surviving my temperatures just fine. It doesn't even wilt in the hottest part of the day. Kale, surprisingly enough, kale is kind of amazing because it can weather really hot weather. It can deal with really cold weather. Some varieties are better at one or the other, but most varieties of kale can pretty much survive almost anything other than a storm. Like once you start getting really bad snowstorms, that can eventually kill it. But up until then, I mean, it's bulletproof, really. So a lot of kale varieties are good options. I actually have some perennial kale I'm experimenting with. They're little seedlings, and they've stayed seedlings for a while because the hot weather has slowed them down. But once it kicks down and they start perking up and hopefully growing some more, I'm hoping to really experiment with those. So perennial kale is also an option. Mustards, which are weird because when you look at them, they are very, you know, soft tissue. They don't have that really kind of tough leaf structure like a cabbage or a kale plant would have. They've got really soft, almost lettucey leaves. And yet they do amazingly well in high heat. I have, you know, I've seen them wilt a little during the worst part of the day, but if you pick them in the mornings when they're still crisp, I've had them be good throughout the summer. Especially back when I was working at the Learning Garden I was working at before, we got mustards all summer long and they were pretty amazing. One thing I've noticed is the heat tends to pick up in the summer. I don't know if that's because the compounds that it needs from the soil to produce that, I think it's a sulfur-based one for those, is more abundant, like available in hotter temperatures, or if it's just the plant's biology that just produces more, maybe to protect it since it's more vulnerable that time of year. I'm not sure which, but I do know that I really like it during the summer, so that works for me. Also Roselle. Roselle grew amazingly well for me for the last couple of years. It's actually a plant I love so much I named my daughter after it. So it produces these beautiful white flowers. They're a hibiscus type flower because it's related to hibiscus. And then the flower gives way to these calyxes around the fruit. You don't actually usually use the fruit that much. They use it a little bit when they make jams and stuff out of it. But when they make Jamaica the drink, they don't actually use the fruit. They use the calyx. And the red calyxes have a really tart, sour flavor. Fresh off the plant, they're kind of an acquired taste, but when you dry them out and then make a kind of a tea type, drink from it, and then you add some sugar and stuff like that, it's pretty great. I actually do like it just on its own because I'm weird that way. But yeah, most people usually prefer it with quite a bit of sugar, but other than that, it's a pretty good all-around plant. You can use the fresh leaf tips. They actually dry that in some places and use as an herb. It's called red sumac. You can also use the younger leaves as a green in salads and stuff like that. It has the same kind of tart, sour flavor. So it's really become one of my favorites. That's all the greens I have. So let's move on to cucurbits. The Greek and Armenian cukes, I grow both of those. They do well. A lot of cucumbers do okay in warmer weather. Lemon cucumbers did especially well for me a couple of years, so I would definitely recommend those. Watermelons are, they're from some of the hottest parts of Africa. They grow out on the savanna. You'll actually have, that's actually a thing that's part of their distribution, is they will grow and you'll have these watermelon vines all over a large stretch of grassland, right? And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily see them from a distance when you look down, but inside the grasses, you can see these these watermelon leaves poking up. And then the whole vine dies off when the plant finishes up, leaving the field with just all these watermelons just laying there. And so the animals pick them up, people pick them up when they can get them. That's how they got domesticated. But yeah, they're a very hot weather plant that does amazingly well in really hot weather. So I've got some growing in mine, and they're growing up a trellis. Haven't gotten to eat any yet, but I'm waiting. Another one that's growing really well for me right now is luffa. I haven't gotten anything off of it yet because I started them a little bit late, but they are dealing with the heat just fine. Root vegetables, the only one I know of that always produces in high heat is sweet potato. Normal potatoes, I know they grow them in the middle of summer here. I haven't had as much luck. I take that back. They don't produce anything I haven't had much luck with early potatoes in the summer, but they do grow over the summer, and then you can pick them in the fall. So potatoes are one you can grow through summer, but they won't produce in summer, if that makes sense. And they also require quite a bit of water. They do have a tendency to not do as well when the soil dries out, whereas sweet potatoes are a little more tolerant of that. And then as far as, you know, grains, a good chunk of grains are summer grains. There are things like winter wheat that aren't, so definitely check. But corn is a good summer grain to grow. Sorghum works really well as well. There's also varieties of other common grains that will grow in summer if you want it. Obviously, grains aren't usually that rewarding to grow in a garden situation. Corn being an exception because it's fun. I don't know that I would have a garden without corn. But most of the grains like wheat and rye and things like that, it's not really that useful to grow your own unless you have a large amount of space, because it takes something on the, you know, average, like a block to, like, not a city block, but like, you know, an average suburban lot to grow enough wheat to really do a whole lot for you for the year. So it's not usually that productive. It's fun to grow it occasionally. I grew some triticale, just a small amount once, just because I find the grain fascinating, but I didn't really do a whole lot with it. Amaranth, corn, sorghum, those are much better crops to grow during the summer for your grains. So that's all about all I had about hot weather gardening and hot climate gardening. The last part I want to talk about, let's call this, I heard it on Facebook, because I heard this on Facebook and I just need to share it with as many people as possible, because there is the worst gardening advice you can find in the world on Facebook. So in this case, somebody had actually basically just posted a picture of some sunflowers. Now, to me, it looks like those sunflowers are just done for the season. But he was asking, you know, he was a new gardener. He wasn't experienced with it. So he was asking, you know, what was wrong with his plants? Why were they dying? Is there any way he can bring them back? Now, my answer was, of course, probably not, because check the seed heads. I think there's probably seed there. They're done. That's it. They're an annual. They, you know, single flower, sunflower varieties grow one flower and then die and let that go to seed. So you're not going to get anything else out of it. It's done. Pull it out, plant something else. But somebody, I don't know why, posted to pour beer on it that would revitalize the plant. And they also claimed that they and their mother had done this several times and it had worked for them. And I don't know where this stuff comes from, because, I mean, I know old wives' tales and gardening are as old as time. So what would happen if you dumped beer on your plant? Well, I don't know for sure, because I've never, ever, once in my life thought of doing that, but there might be some nutrients in the beer, but not really enough to matter. What I think is more likely to happen is beer still contains quite a bit of sugar. Not tons. Obviously, a lot of that's become alcohol, but there's still a surprising amount of sweetness to beer. That's why we use bittering agents. Obviously, nowadays, we pretty much just use hops, but historically, they used a whole bunch of other herbs. But you use bittering agents to take the edge off that sweetness, because basically, it's just grain sugars. And so we ferment those grain sugars, and everything that's left is sugar and alcohol. And you're dumping sugar and alcohol, and maybe if it's a if it's not a pasteurized beer, then you're probably putting a little bit of yeast in there. But you're just gonna cause a crust, because you're literally sugaring the earth and you're pouring alcohol over it. So it's going to kill most of the bacterial life there. And you're supplanting that with a yeast colony, which will probably not survive in that environment for super long. So essentially, you're probably sterilizing a small portion of soil, crusting it up, causing other problems, creating an environment that when the bacteria comes back is going to be very welcoming to bacteria, especially fungi, mold, other things you don't want there. It will likely attract insects and will probably attract snails and slugs because they are attracted to the smell of beer. That's why beer traps are a common way to catch snails and slugs. So this is all bad. Like, there's no reason to do this. I'm sure somebody will pop in to tell me, hey, we've done it for years, it's worked for us, because any piece of gardening advice you can find, no matter how insane, somebody will claim works for them. But yeah, no, any benefits you see from this have to be coincidence, because that doesn't make any sense chemically at all. And chemistry, as you probably guess from everything I said about hot plants, chemistry is a big part of gardening, and that is bad chemistry. So don't do that. So that's all I had to say about that, and all I had to say about pretty much everything. Just want to thank you guys for listening, and if you can, go ahead and go on Podchaser, search for TJ's Garden, and leave a review. If you leave a review, there is an option to share that on Twitter and other social media. If you do any of that for me, I'd really appreciate it, because that does help spread the show around. So thank you so much. Have a great day, and go out and enjoy your garden.